Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal. I have the pleasure today of speaking from a bright early morning with a colleague from the East Midlands in England. Momentarily, you'll hear the voice of Nero Sirawardena, who's from the University of Lincoln, and we're going to be talking about a paper that he and his colleagues have coming out in the December 2019 issue of Medical Education, entitled Performance in Canada's Declaring versus Not Declaring Dyslexia in a Licensing Clinical Exam. Nero, thank you very much for taking the time to talk.
You're very welcome, Kevin. Delighted to be able to speak to you about the paper.
I am too. It's an issue that, at least in Canada, is becoming more and more prominent as people become more aware and try harder to understand what accommodations are necessary for individuals dealing with things like dyslexia. For the sake of those who are outside of England, can you give us some sense of how big an issue it is for you in the UK? How many candidates would typically identify themselves as being dyslexic?
So the number of candidates with specific learning differences, of which the majority have dyslexia, is increasing in number. Currently, for our licensing exam in general practice, it's around 5%, it's between 5 and 10%, but it has been increasing year on year. So it is becoming an important issue, and particularly with the legislation here in the UK, but I think also in the US and Australia, around fairness for different groups of candidates, this is becoming something that we're very focused on.
And for the sake of those people out there who don't grapple with dyslexia or others with specific learning differences, what is the clinical definition in your context?
Okay, I think the clinical definition of dyslexia is that it's a specific learning difference that particularly affects ability to read and process information. So there are more complex definitions than that, but that's essentially what we're talking about.
Thanks very much. That's actually one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you today, is I think most people think about dyslexia as being a reading issue. And in the OSCE, as it's commonly employed, there's obviously a bit of reading as somebody prepares to go into a room to engage with a simulated patient. But the bulk of the OSCE itself is interaction. And so I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you were thinking that those with these learning differences might be challenged on an OSCE specifically as opposed to a written exam, and what sort of accommodations as a result tend to be made in your context?
Well, as you can imagine, we were very surprised to find differences in an OSCE for people with specific learning differences. These are doctors in general practice training in the UK. We had published a paper a couple of years ago looking at the applied knowledge test, which is a written computer mark test for GP trainees, and found no significant differences once other factors had been taken into account, like the sex of the candidate, ethnicity, where they'd qualified, whether it was in the UK or abroad, and some other features. But we were very surprised to find that in the OSCE, the clinical skills assessment here in the UK, that there were significant differences, albeit small, for those candidates taking the assessment. In terms of why that might be, I think we can really only hypothesize why that might be. And in the paper, we describe some possible reasons. I think the key thing that I've come to understand through doing this work around dyslexia and assessment is that it's not just about reading and writing. It's a condition which can affect attention, concentration, sequencing of tasks, organization, time management, the prioritization of tasks as well, also, reading under pressure is different from reading under other conditions, but it can also affect memory, recall. And so those are things that potentially could affect performance. I mean, I think there are a couple of other things to mention that we thought through discussion may be factors. We found in the applied knowledge test that there weren't significant differences once these other factors were taken into account. But the accommodations include, as a standard, 25% extra time for the written test, but not in the clinical skills assessment. And the other thing to mention is that these doctors are very familiar with written tests and, you know, machine mark tests, computer-based assessments, and that familiarity and the opportunity to develop workarounds, I think, is less the case for OSCEs. And I think the other thing is these reasonable adjustments are different for OSCEs compared to written tests. Just to tell you what the reasonable adjustments are or accommodations for the clinical skills assessment. So candidates with dyslexia have to have an accredited expert who says that they have dyslexia and what accommodations they require on applying to the exam. They're allowed an additional 10 minutes for the pre-reading, so that's the information about the cases beforehand. And they're also allowed a paper version rather than reading on an iPad. So some people with dyslexia would find that easier with a paper version. So those are the accommodations allowed. But there isn't, in the normal situation, extra time allowed because the clinical skills assessment, OSCE, is a circuit where candidates go around the circuit of 13 cases. And so because there are many candidates during a day that will be going around this circuit, there isn't an opportunity for additional time to be provided.
Right. I'd love to talk a bit more about the possibility for accommodations and the experiences as you understood them to be for this group of candidates. It occurs to me I should probably ask you to backfill just a little bit. We sort of jumped to the finding that there was a difference. It's often very difficult to tease apart the effect of a particular condition like this versus other confounding variables. Do you mind just saying a little bit for our listeners about the things that you did to try to ensure that you were getting as clean a comparison as possible?
Okay, so just by way of background, we looked at almost 20,000 candidates taking the exam over an 8-year period between 2010 and 2017. And we know that there are certain attributes of candidates that affect their likelihood of passing. So sex is important. Females more likely than males to pass the clinical skills assessment. Where they qualified, whether in the UK or abroad, is also very important. Ethnicity, we found for the assessment, can affect that, and obviously there's an overlap with where they qualified. So we looked at white candidates versus black and minority ethnic candidates. We also looked at a couple of other things, the number of attempts that they'd taken, because the attempt is a very strong predictor of whether a candidate will pass or not. And they're allowed usually 4 attempts in this exam and an exceptional 5th attempt. And the other thing that we also included on the advice of one of the reviewers was the scaled mark at first attempt. And the reason for doing that is that there's a strong link between subsequent marks and the mark at the first attempt. But also that the data, as you can imagine, are very skewed towards passing because most candidates do pass this test either at the first or a second attempt.
I understand you also had 3 groups, those who never declared dyslexia, those who declared it prior to their first examination, and those who declared it later. Can you explain a little bit more why you separated those latter 2 groups?
We separated those because some candidate will declare early What I mean by that is before their first attempt. And those are usually candidates who've known to have dyslexia often throughout their educational career. They're different because they've had an opportunity to be provided support and themselves to develop workarounds to get over the differences in the way that they're processing information, reading or writing. And because some of these candidates will have had many years of trying to figure out how to overcome any particular difficulties, they, you know, would be at less of a disadvantage. We found in the written exam that this was, you know, affected whether candidates passed at their first attempt or subsequently. And we also found a difference in this exam. So some candidates will only declare dyslexia after they failed once or more. And that's often because they've not been diagnosed with dyslexia early during their educational career, or decided for whatever reason not to declare it at their first attempt and not to seek accommodations. And I think this is partly related to, in some countries, there is no screening of dyslexia early on in education. And also there are problems with stigma related to dyslexia, which means that people are less likely to declare and less likely to get support for that problem.
In terms of the comparison itself, I suppose a skeptic could wonder about whether or not those declaring late are actually declaring to try to account for or better their position, knowing that they've already had a fail on the exam. But the adjustments you just described in terms of accounting for that earlier performance should enable that confound to be addressed. Is that correct?
I think so. In terms of the candidates who declare dyslexia late, what's quite interesting to me looking at the literature is obviously these are usually very bright people who've been through their whole educational career and, you know, got into medicine. I think they're also particularly able because they've developed workarounds to deal with their specific learning difference. And it's only at these very high stakes exams right at the end that they have problems. And what this is exposing for me is that we don't really understand in sufficient detail what the difficulties are that candidates are experiencing. I mean, in relation to their diagnosis after failing, again, that's made by an accredited educational expert, you know, using standard techniques. This is not people who don't have dyslexia who are declaring it. These are people who, I believe, genuinely have dyslexia, who've just not been picked up earlier because they've managed to function, you know, reasonably well despite some, you know, difference in their functioning.
Right, thank you for clarifying that. The reason I wanted to make sure that we spent a bit of time making that absolutely clear was I would imagine that while both groups performed less well than those who haven't been declared to have dyslexia, the strategies that you're describing that those who were identified early have been able to develop might offer some insight into what sort of accommodations or strategies need to be put in place for all. Were you able to get any sense from the differences in those two populations of strategies that could help overcome this potential bias with the exam for future candidates?
Yeah, so because this is a quantitative cross-sectional study, I mean, what we did find was that if you took 100 people who never declared dyslexia, 95 out of 100 early declarers would pass the exam, whereas 2 out of 100 late declarers would pass the exam overall. So you see quite a marked difference there in early versus late declarers, and even the early declarers still had around about 5 in 100 less chance of passing the exam. More difference compared to those who never declared dyslexia, but it's sufficient for us to want to look further. And I think this is where qualitative research would be really helpful. So looking exactly as you say it, the strategies that candidates with dyslexia are using, but also what difficulties they're having in negotiating the clinical skills assessment, in negotiating those circuits. What are the specific difficulties and problems that they're having that we could address through either reasonable accommodations or through training and preparation?
Kept you longer than I normally do for these interviews, but I can't resist but asking one more question. I hope you don't mind, but I can't help but imagining those who run OSCEs and the incredible logistical challenge that they are in the best of situations. I can just imagine how they might react to being told that the exam needs to be made special in some way for those who have these sorts of specific learning differences. How do you balance the need to support this population with the logistic difficulties of putting on an exam like an OSCE, especially one that's high stakes, is the context that you've been using here?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think there are a couple of ways to think about this. The first is that these are doctors who've been through their whole medical career, their educational career before that, obviously very able to have got to that stage. They're now going into licensing. And the idea that right at the end of that long educational career that they don't pass licensing because of something that could be remediable, I think is a really important thing for us to think about. In terms of balancing that with how we address that, it's not just about thinking around reasonable accommodations, although I think that may be important because there may be accommodations that we could implement that actually could help. I don't know what those are, and I think that's where the qualitative research would help. The obvious answer is more time to run the circuit for particular individuals, but that may not be the answer that the qualitative research provides. It may be other things that are required. I think the other thing is that preparation could actually help and familiarization with the OSCE. I think particularly in situations of great stress, I think that familiarity could be a great help to individuals with specific learning differences. I mean, I think ultimately it is about balance, and the accommodations that have to be provided have to be reasonable. Nevertheless, there is a legislative, if you like, pressure on exams to try and do all that they can within reason to have a level playing field for people, particularly with what we would call protected characteristics here in the UK. I don't know if that term is used elsewhere as well. And it is about providing a level playing field rather than specifically advantaging one group of candidates over another. So I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it's perfect. It indicates clearly that there is work yet to be done, but at the same time, some intriguing and potentially valuable leads.
The other thing I wanted to mention, Kevin, is that some people say to me, well, you know, that medicine's a difficult job. You have to do it under pressure, and we have to consult within a certain length of, you know, 10 minutes or whatever one does in certain jurisdictions. But actually, that might be the case for some individuals, and it may work perfectly well, but often these timings are arbitrary, you know, a 10-minute consultation, and many doctors consult longer than that. But the other thing to take into account is this is a high-stakes exam, and so the requirement to consult under pressure during a high-stakes exam isn't necessarily correct for these folk who've spent a long educational career trying to get to this stage.
Right, another valuable note to keep in mind and a good note to wrap up on, I think. So I'll thank you for your time and your insights. I'll remind our listeners that we've been talking about a paper that will be in the December 2019 issue of Medical Education called Performance in Candidates Declaring versus Not Declaring Dyslexia in a Licensing Clinical Exam. And you've been hearing the author of that work, Nero Sirivardhana, who has made some significant strides. And we look forward, Nero, to seeing where else this leads you.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.